this feels like a show which has kind of lost its spirit a bit. I could see in a different timeline where Doctor Who did not regenerate into Patrick Troughton, and this was the sort of tired back end of a format which just wasn't able to sustain itself.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Castaras. My name is Christian Corley, and in a few minutes' time, you'll hear the rest of that conversation as we go deep into those two recovered Daleks Master Plan episodes. But before I do that, I'm recording this little intro because something strange happened. We shared the podcast in its Patreon form, so only a limited number of people can actually listen to it. So we shared it on Facebook with the title, and curiously, lots of people had thoughts about our discussion, even though they hadn't heard it, which I thought was amazing. How are these people so insightful that they know exactly what we think just from one snippet of audio and a title? So to you guys who listen every week, and to those newcomers who don't usually listen, I would encourage you to listen to this whole discussion between myself and James McLean about the rediscovered episodes 1 and 3 from the Daleks Master Plan. You don't have to agree. I don't agree with what James is saying, and James doesn't agree wholly with my take either. That's the beauty of doing podcasts, where we can talk about things and talk with you and find out what each other thinks about things. Opinions aren't wrong. They are opinions, and by definition, they're not wrong. So let's get into it, and I'll be very interested to know what everyone thinks about this, and we will be coming back to this topic in the near future. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Castaras. My name is Christian Corley, he's James McLean, and we are here to chat about those two episodes from the Daleks Master Plan that have been recovered, let's say. Apparently they weren't really lost at all. We've individually watched the episode 1 and episode 3 of the Daleks Master Plan on BBC iPlayer over the past few days, and actually, I was chatting with Brian Turnover. He's watched them. They get in the United States, they can watch it on YouTube, apparently. So if you weren't aware of this and you're in the USA, you can watch the two episodes on YouTube. And with whatever, I don't know, adverts you may wish to put up with or otherwise. So they're there. And I thought it'd be a good idea for us to talk about them, just, we've already sort of preambled them a few weeks ago, and you know, the Easter weekend has happened, and you know, families and Easter eggs and things like that kind of slow these discussions down somewhat. But I think also it's given me time to kind of, I've watched the first episode twice, in order to sort of digest what's there, because one of the things, James, that I noticed, and I mentioned this to Brian as well, is how what's happening in your head when you get an audio and you're experiencing the audio version of something is, and I suppose it's a bit like imagining a band playing live almost, is that what you're actually seeing is completely different to what's in your head. And that works in two ways. It's a good, because it's a, you know, there's a good aspect to that because you're seeing it at last, but also it kind of changes what's going on in your head completely. And seeing these in, you know, as they were intended, has brought them to life in a way that I didn't think was likely. Having seen the clips from the other episodes and the pieces of the other episodes that exist, and the telly snaps, those aside, and then we've got the various reconstructions, and we've got Rick Lundeen's graphic novel as well. You've got all those different versions of it, much like, I suppose, maybe a bit like Shada, which you've talked about a few times. But bringing this to the Daleks Master Plan, it's alive in a completely new and different way.
Yeah, it's so exciting to see these two old episodes brought to life on television. In a way that I could ever imagined, and I've waited for probably 35 years. It's been 35 years.
Yeah.
Every day I've waited to see these two episodes, and now they're here, and I can't believe it. It's an incredible experience. I've I've, like you, I've wondered what they'd be like. I've got to the point where I've actually started to, I've etched them into the floor each episode based on the telly snaps. I've then put the floor on a very fast conveyor belt to see if I could make it animate them so I could actually physically see what. I don't care. I watched them and I then went off and did something else. They are, for me, sadly, very unmemorable. And
really?
Yeah. I just don't. I mean, it's not a great story in itself. It's not. At the time, I think even Purvis has sort of said it was, he saw it as a woeful, bad misstep in the show. And it sort of feels it in a weird way. It's, when I watched it, I was thinking, this here is an example I could see in a different timeline where Doctor Who did not regenerate into Patrick Troughton. And this was the sort of tired back end of a format which just wasn't able to sustain itself. Because if you didn't have the regeneration, if that hadn't come to light, this feels like a show which has kind of lost its spirit a bit. And I don't know. It just didn't really do much for me. I mean, I don't think I've gotten into them as much as you. I watched the both of them once. I have seen the other episodes that are available, which is what, two of them, is it? Two or three, yeah. I have listened to the John Peel audio adaptation of the audiobooks read by Gene Marsh and Purvis. So I am familiar with it. But I suppose I never really had any massive interest in it beforehand. I think that's probably the difference between you and me. Mm-hmm. Is that when I'd seen these things, because it's an era or part of an era which has little meaning to me, I find the Stephen Taylor era not very good. I don't think that's not Purvis's fault. And I don't think it's even Stephen Taylor's fault. I think the fault is, unfortunately, you took two quite realistic characters and then you brought in this futuristic hero, which is almost like a very, very flattened, grumpy version of Ian. And it's the Hartnell himself is just not enough to carry it for me. It didn't blow me away. And I didn't expect it to be fair. Mm-hmm. And it is what it is. If I was to find stuff that I did think was interesting in it, which we can talk about, I think the most interesting in it thing for me is Katrina.
Right, yeah.
I think Katrina is the most interesting and fascinating either good call or misstep I'm undecided upon.
Well, they decided misstep, didn't they? Because they kicked her out.
And there's evidence in that episode where they sort of, where you can see it, where it gets to the point where the Doctor has to explain what a key is, you know, because...
Apparently they had no keys in ancient Greece.
So, you know, they had to explain a key. She has to have a tablet explained to her. And they just felt it was just going to drag everything on, as you were alluding to. So, yeah, that I think is... So seeing her in a little more than what we've seen before was interesting. Because mm-hmm. we've got the episode after, haven't we? That one's available. Is it the one episode after that?
Oh, gosh. Let's just double-check that. Because these things do get confusing when it comes to sort of repeated episodes of being...
Well, this
found.
Is it. I've watched them, but I've not watched them in a long time, and I've only watched them once because it's not an era which blows me away. So when I heard that they were the ones that had been found, I was obviously pleased that we've got a bit of a legacy, and it was interesting to see it in terms of a production. But of all the one missing episodes...
Yep, so episodes 1, 2, and 3 exist. Yep. So episode 2, it was Day of Armageddon. So yes, we'd already seen Day of Armageddon.
We have one more with Katrina.
The Traitors.
The Traitors is the one where she...
Episode 4, yeah.
Episode 4 is where she goes. So yep. We have now three of the four from the Daleks' Master Plan, and obviously we've got nothing from Mythmakers. So in the sense of Katrina, I think that is probably its most valuable find, is increasing the experience of seeing that character, which otherwise is pretty much long lost to the... to viewers of the show. So yeah, Katrina, I think, is the most interesting thing there for me. I think it's interesting, I suppose, seeing Hartnell's performance, which feels a little bit of a mix of someone who is struggling, but also by this point is like, well, let's face it, and just looking at your, what I'm assuming is just trolling T-shirt for middle-aged men watching this, Yoda. He is just like Yoda by this point, isn't he? He is pre-Yoda.
Well, I mean, it's one way of looking at it. I mean, I thought he looked like he's enjoying himself with it. So, I mean, he's, you know, he's working with good people.
You could swap him over with that puppet in that episode and you wouldn't notice the difference.
Well, you've got Nick Courtney as well. First appearance in Doctor Who.
Yeah, but if you didn't know Nick Courtney was going to have a legacy with science fiction conventions and eye patches, you would think nothing of that performance. It's fine, but it is a very run-of-the-mill character for Doctor Who. It's again, from a historical perspective, it's interesting to see Courtney in that space where we've got him in the third episode, but we don't have much.
And you've got Brian Cant as well.
Oh, thank God for that.
Well, I know.
Yeah, we wouldn't see him elsewhere. I mean, this is what I mean. It's one of those things where I think, yeah, historically, it's a really great to have these finds. There's no doubt about it. And there's lots of little things in the episode we can talk about. Personally, there isn't that much there to really...
Okay. Well, let's talk about Mavic Chen then.
Okay.
Because Mavic Chen is a bit of a poser, isn't he?
A bit of a poser. In what way?
A bit of a poser. For example, in episode 3, when the seaweed person is dispatched by the Daleks, he's found stood behind some Daleks in a strange pose, and then he's got this thing going on when he's thanking people, and you know, there's obviously, I mean, there's. You couldn't take Mavic Chen's character, not so much his characterization, the look he's been given as being some kind of some racial thing. But there's also, yes. I think, there's more to it than that. But also, I think there seems to be a Ming the Merciless line, a thread through that as well. He's very much, I mean, and it's a typical Kevin Stoney performance, isn't it? Where he's this very sort of like assured bad guy who knows everything. He's on top of everything. But the fact that he just stands there doing these strange poses, I thought that was quite amusing.
But that's episode 3.
That's episode 3. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So talk about episode 1 and 2.
Well, we're talking about episodes 1 and 3.
Oh, are we?
Yes, we are. Yes.
Was it episode 1 and 3 that we've got?
Yes.
So we've missed an episode and I didn't notice.
Episode 2 already existed, Day of Armageddon, yes.
Oh, I see what you mean. That's interesting because I didn't really notice that. It's been a long time since I've seen episode 2. But I didn't really notice the massive jump. Well, I did notice the massive jump. But because I think so little happens in those, because it's literally been deliberately stretched out.
Yes, of course, yeah.
I just thought it was a bit of lazy...
Well, it was supposed to be a six-parter. That was the thing. It was supposed to be a six-parter and the... head of the BBC wanted lots of Daleks and wasn't happy with the chase.
Yeah.
So asked for the six-parter to become a 12-parter. Terry Nation had submitted a six-part story in the way that he tends to do, the same story. And then there was Dennis Spooner, one of his colleagues from his agency, he wrote the other parts of it, and it would appear that the script editor did some revision as well. That's Donald Tosh, I think. So that's how we got to 12 parts. As far as I can recall, Termination wrote episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and episode Christmas, which episode that is, 7, maybe? Yes, episode 7. So then Spooner wrote the others. So... I mean, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, weren't we, as well, how you observed the second half of the serial lacks, I think you said something like it lacks a pace or it lacks the urgency of the first half of the serial or something along those lines, which may be because the second half of the serial isn't written by Terry Nation.
Mm. Well, but the second part of the serial is them dawdling around time, very chase-like in a lot of ways.
Stretched out.
You know, suddenly you have the monk as well that becomes...
Yes.
So, it's a messy season. And while you can, in a weird way, sort of laud some of the big scope of it, this whole idea of these galaxies coming together, which just feels patently ridiculous now. I mean, in a weird way, I mean, while I wouldn't have wanted the mission to the unknown to be the one they found, because it is, in a weird way, I think it's one of the stronger stories of the lot. It's one of the bolder.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the problem. The master plan feels very safe and constructed, and it is. In a weird way, it's one of the most disappointing ones to have found, although one would argue, is any of them disappointing? Is anything to be found disappointing? Is something over nothing better? And it certainly is. But when you've got things like, you know, you've got the Mythmakers missing, you obviously, people go for Marco Polo as a host of Troughtons, and it's a master plan. And two episodes which lurk around an episode we already have. So it doesn't really expand the sense of the scope of the story or the aesthetic of the story. It didn't really do that much for me.
Okay. The director is Douglas Canfield on this, which isn't, bearing in mind some of his later stuff with in the Tom Baker in particular, isn't immediately obvious.
Yeah, well, I hadn't made that connection while watching it.
Yeah, so and I think it's a strong point that you made. I think that you know Mission to the Unknown does set up something, and it does it in such a way that Doctor Who hadn't done before. It's not really done it since very often, that kind of thing, and it arguably what you get with the 12-parter a few weeks later is possibly underwhelming, which is what I think you were getting towards. But I mean, it isn't perfect Doctor Who. It isn't perfect television. It's old television. It's old Doctor Who. It's, you know, it's late Hartnell Doctor Who. You know, there's lots of been written about this. I think he's fine. And, you know, you think otherwise. I think he's great in it. He looks like he's having a lot of fun. I love the, it was released with the trailer parts of the bit where his wig's a complete mess. And maybe there is some kind of retreading with the Daleks. But then again, it's Daleks. So everything's going to be a retread with Daleks, whether it's the Doctor or the Daleks doing the retreading, or the Daleks' motivations or the Doctor's reaction to the Daleks isn't going to be necessarily anything new. But it's great that we've got these episodes now. And I was interested in the quality of what we got, because it felt very much like, we know that a lot of cleaning up has been done, but it would seem that the cleaning up has only been able to get to a standard of existing 1960s Doctor Who, even with the film segment. Did you notice there's the film segment when Brian Cant gets killed? It switches from video to film there, and his hair is slightly different.
I hadn't noticed that, no.
Yeah.
No.
I've made a few notes. There's a warning. I didn't notice this on the UK versions, but I understand there's a discriminatory content warning on YouTube. Now, I was watching The French Connection the other evening on Disney Plus, where there's a very clear use of the N-word within the first 10 minutes. No warning on Disney Plus for that. these things are kind of... They do seem to be inconsistent. The bald guys as well. I was watching the control center and the bald guys, and I was I was thinking of Harry Hill, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I see multiple bald people on television, I always think of Harry Hill's TV burp, and you'd always get one of the bald people that had been in a clip to appear on the show with him and say it was one of his brothers, you know. I think that he's a bunch of Harry Hill brothers. But there's the other thing as well, because, you know, you just, this isn't great Doctor Who, etc. But I disagree, because there's some interesting writing in here that you don't normally get with Terry Nation prior to Blake Seven.
Right.
Nice to hear his speech again. That is one of the most brilliant pieces of satirical writing in Doctor Who for the entire decade almost. And that's in a Terry Nation episode. I think that's brilliant. That just says everything you need to know about Mavic Chen in that that one line. And I think that's absolutely excellent. Now, I'm really pleased with it. I enjoyed watching it. It was nice, you know, again, William Hartnell's little fluff in episode 3 as well, aside. The model work was okay. I enjoyed watching them. It was nice. It was nice to have a... I'm one of these people... I'm very hurt by the chase. The chase is a huge missed opportunity. And, you know, we don't have all 12 episodes of this. So, visually speaking, one cannot determine... possibly ever, whether the Dalek's Master Plan is a missed opportunity. But watching two additional episodes from it, it's fun and engaging, and I never felt bored with this the way I did watching The Chase.
Well, The Chase is bad. I mean...
Oh, it's terrible.
It's a weird act of the gods that when they're throwing away cans of film, they were going through and they go, what do we throw away? And they look and they'd see The Chase and they'd see Marco Polo, Chase, Marco Polo, I'll just get rid of Marco Polo. What else should we get rid of? Chase, Mythmakers, Chase, I'll just get rid of the Mythmakers,
yeah, yeah.
You know. Chase, third of Patrick Troughton, let's just get rid of, you know. It's and that still sits there proudly. Yeah. And
that's not exactly what happened, though. This isn't a reconstruction.
I'm pretty sure it is what happened. I'm pretty sure
that okay.
it's exactly what happened. Chase is, I mean, the Chase to me is almost like the beginning of the end for Hartnell's era, and it's an era, and it's not Nation's fault per se. It's an era, it's a show which is very new to a point where it is untested in any. There's no format like it in terms of its. Construction, and sort of by The Chase, you're feeling it starting to settle into kind of what it is, or what it can be as a running production, where you've got, you know, by that at that point, a lot of episodes running per year, and what it is actually fairly bland television, and I don't think there is that much after The Chase, which to me is particularly. Astounding until you get a shift of gears for Troughton.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even Troughton takes a bit of a while before it finds its
feet. Yes, it does, yeah. Yeah, I think
but,
so.
I mean, maybe the 10th Planet is perhaps a point where there is actually a slight shift of gears, but even that I don't think is a particularly mind-blowing story. There's some nice imageries in it. But yeah, I think the Chase is a bad point, and it's a point where... But then, like you say, I mean, I've not seen the whole of Mission to the Unknown, but having listened and then read it and or read then listened to it and then seen the various stuff, you know, a lot of it feels very. I imagine it's very Chase-like. Outside of these setup episodes, but yeah, I just don't. I couldn't say I was bored, but I wasn't enthralled through the two episodes either. And I think, and in part, again, that comes from existing, as you say, we're in a different time period now. In terms of Doctor Who, ignoring the fact that it's slower pace, because let's face it, we've watched a lot of slow paced stuff if you've watched Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
There's very little that it's doing which you haven't seen before. I mean, Stephen unwell in the TARDIS while the Doctor heads out feels almost like a pre-tread. To Planet of the Daleks, which again, who wrote Planet of the Daleks?
And I'm
let
not
me
sure.
just check. Let me. I've yes. got this on my phone somewhere. In a weird way, and this is always the case. It's a bit like, I know my mum always says how amazing it was to be around when the Beatles appeared, and the sound was like something that was fresh and totally unheard of for her. It blew her away. Well, to me, growing up when there was, you know, Oasis and various other bands of the 90s and the 60s had been done, you could never get that spark, that feeling that you'd have had there, because you've had so many iterations since then that the original no longer carries the same impact as it would if you'd first heard it. And she said actually the same for Doctor Who. Seeing Doctor Who for the first time blew her mind, you know, that first episode, because nothing had been done like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Master Plan does struggle in that sense, that invariably it's not ever going to have been a mind-blowing set of episodes. And you are now watching it from jaded eyes, who've seen many Doctor Who's, and as you have alluded to, many Terry Nations post-Master Plan, from which he has cribbed and borrowed from his fame and his story box. But yeah, I thought Katrina was really interesting. I thought Katrina was, I thought it was fascinating in how she was played, the way that she worked within the story. It's funny because in a weird way now, even though the TV show clearly would never do it now as well, bizarrely, I thought her involvement was a quite nice, was a refreshing disruptor, because she didn't understand virtually anything.
Yeah.
That made her an interesting point for a companion. And I find it almost infuriating. I always want to sit down with people who are now long past dead and say, look, you're idiots. Because for so long you played on this line that a companion had to be X, Y, and Z, which is largely a point of question for the main character, something to get into trouble, and something pretty to look at. And in the end, what makes interesting television is something like Katrina. And someone like Vicky is not interesting television.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
And you got rid of this person who has an interesting disruption, not just to the story, but maybe to yourselves, to give you ways of trying to find new ways of approaching a story. Which, I suppose, in fairness, if you are running when you've got a lot of episodes to do a year, you just don't want that. You just want to get them out. But yeah, I just found watching it, Katrina was the most interesting thing I found in it, because I just weren't quite sure how she's going to play that. You don't get anything like her again till Leela, really.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I mean, maybe if they'd just written her better, they wouldn't have decided to get rid of her.
That's the point.
Yeah.
They didn't want to write her better. They wanted something staple.
But just like the whole characterization thing, this she may not have known what a tablet was. Okay, I can get along with that. She will have known what a key was, though. I've just double checked this because I was pretty sure that the ancient Greeks had keys and locks. They did. So, you know, the whole notion of her not understanding what a key is, there's this kind of like childish simplicity to what an ancient Greek is, and like this notion. This is something that gets my goat, actually. We've stumbled upon one of my bugbears, my bête noirs, this idea that people from the past are in some way completely primitive. And, you know, before like the Victorian era, everyone was an ape or some, you know, this nonsense, and there's no form of technology or anything in the past. So yeah, the ancient Greeks, I've just double checked this because I was pretty sure I've read this previously. Keys in ancient Greek, yeah, the history of keys, clay tablets from the ancient Babylonian Empire almost 4,000 years ago depict keys. You know, people have been using keys for millennia. Better writing of a character, and I kind of, we got this with Leela as well, I suppose, in some ways, because she starts off being very primitive despite coming from a kind of like a de-technologicalized tribe, and then she slowly becomes more, and yeah, maybe she's going to become more au fait with things as she travels more with the Doctor, but she's less of the primitive by the end of it, while still having some primitive elements to it. And it's to do with the characterization and the writing. And Doctor Who is not a kitchen sink drama in 1965, 66. It's not being written by the best writers on television. It's been written by people who write television to deliver adventures and, you know, the boys' own element to, you know, the reinterpreting things that they were enjoying as they were children, bring these adventures and science fiction to, and maybe reflecting the real world. And yes, there is satire in Terry Nations writing, etc. But many of the characters are very two-dimensional, aren't they? And I agree with you. I think they had a good opportunity with Katarina, which they didn't take.
But I think some of that is also, it's not misogynistic, but I think there is a certain element of, as you say, is men writing a show in a culture which is very male. Television is very male dominated, mm-hmm. and is watched and controlled by the man of the house. So invariably you get a very male sided way. And it's funny that they go to Katrina and go, we just can't write this. She's just, you know, it'd just be too complicated. And this is what, 65? And yet then you've got what, about 66, 67, Jamie appears, who is a Highlander who knows absolutely nothing. But that's fine. We can work with that. A guy that works, that kind of works for us. Now, I could be totally unfair there, because in a sense, it's not like they did that a lot with the male characters either. Well, whenever they had male characters, very rarely, because they obviously had their male hero, and it's because they kept the male hero fairly youthful after Hartnell. They didn't need a second man to do the action bit, so fair enough. But I think, again, you look at Jamie, who is, you know, one of the most popular, probably the most popular male companions, if not the most popular male companion outside of Adric. And he is interesting because he is a fish out of water. And I think Katrina could have been a fish out of water.
Yeah.
I know it just had as a very, and again, it comes back to what you were saying, is that even though people look at ancient Greek for its pioneering intellect, its maths, they don't see it as in people. And you could just had her as being a very smart person, quick on the uplift. I mean, God, humans go into that TARDIS, they don't know what it is, and they don't spend every episode poking, what's this control?
Yeah.
What's this time vortex? Explain to me, I don't understand what a time vortex is. Is this a whirlypool, Doctor? You can find your way around this stuff. And the point being, I think Katrina at the time would have given Doctor Who something a little fresh and challenging for itself and its audience, which I think it was really lacking. And in some ways, I would almost argue that maybe one of the things which, now I'm feeling a bold intervention coming on.
Here,
maybe the thing which saved Doctor Who, and I see you going, algorithms, maybe this will be a second episode we can use now, is Jamie McCribben. Because I think he might be the thing which possibly saved the format. Because if you think of, I mean, Ben and Polly, sweet guys, but no one remembers
them.
Bit dull. You can say, well, they're with Patrick Troughton, still dull. It's not until you get Jamie that pops up. Do you feel that there becomes something where it becomes more than just a Doctor-led show? It does feel, when you watch those episodes, and I imagine when you're watching it as well, it is Doctor and Jamie. Masters of time travel, flying through the vortex. He is, I think, something which that gives the show a new sense of life, a new sense of, and for the writers as well, because you suddenly have an action hero with lead character. Both of them can do lots of energy. So it's not like you're using Stephen to supplement what Hartnell can't do. Trow can be running around, hopping around, jumping around, getting excited, and Jamie can be doing all the sort of gruff masculine stuff as well, and it works really well for them. And it breaks that format a bit as well, because Ben wasn't doing any of that really, which was odd because he was, you know, a hard and cockney sailor.
But I
think people like Jamie and Katrina, Katrina could have been a lost opportunity to sort of give the show a little more of a. But as you say, the problem is, and again, this comes down to sensibilities of the time, you never see the Doctor really trying to educate Jamie. You tend to see the Doctor exasperated when Jamie doesn't understand anything, but doesn't spend the time. But if Jamie had been a Jane, like a bit with, there was the argument that was meant to be there with Leela, but it didn't really happen, thankfully, or even with Ace to a degree, that there would have been something for the Doctor to have had to educate and to My Fair Lady, which is a shame because you don't see him My Fair Lady and Jamie. Which, again, is fascinating.
Yes.
And I think, you know, again, you get to the end of Pratt, which I think is even more interesting when you have Zoe in there, who's the other, and you have this really
She's the other end of the scale, isn't she?
Other end of the scale.
Yeah.
And you have the three of them, which I think is a great three. You have this person who's not very well educated, but full of spirit. You have this over-intellectualized, but slightly naive, or character from the future. And then you have the Doctor as well. And that's a great mix. So, yeah, I think good Doctor Who comes from having a good mix. And at this time, I don't think they quite had it. And which is a shame, because I think in himself, I think Stephen, having watched him more over the last few years, I've warmed to Stephen a lot more than I did when I first saw him. Because, again, as I say, I saw him as this Ian incumbent who just couldn't,
yeah,
couldn't do the stuff. But in himself, he's quite grumpy. He's quite pushy. And yet at the same time, Purvis is quite charming.
Yes, yeah,
he's
yeah.
He's not a
yeah.
bad character, but he has very little to foil off. And I think that's the problem.
He's got great hair as well.
He has got very good hair.
Okay, at this point in the podcast, the remainder of the discussion is for our patrons only. You can join at www.patreon.com/casterbris. There you can sign up. You can enjoy the trial period as well to help you make your mind up. And there you'll discover early edition podcasts, video edition podcasts, the Casterbris archive, and other additional items of interest that go back years. We've got interviews, discussions, reviews, and in-depth discussions of individual television episodes from the last couple of series of Doctor Who. So if you want the full podcast, head over to the Patreon. If you're not a Patreon member, we're going to jump to the end of this week's show. If you have any suggestions as to which Doctor Who serials from 2005 onwards would be more interesting to rediscover new, let us know. And also let us know if you have any thoughts on the Daleks Master Plan episodes 1 and 3 rediscoveries as well. We'll be back for another chat soon. If you're listening on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and those places, look out for the third part of our Silver Nemesis commentary as well. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.